Part 1. The Pet Cemetery. Jesus said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go, that I may awake him out of his sleep." Then the disciples looked at each other, and some smiled because they did not know Jesus had spoken in a figure. "Lord, if he sleeps, he shall do well." So then Jesus spoke to them more plainly. "Lazarus is dead, yes. Nevertheless, let us go to him." John's Gospel, paraphrase. 1. Lewis Creed, who had lost his father at 3 and who had never known a grandfather, never expected to find a father as he entered his middle age. But that was exactly what happened, although he called this man a friend, as a grown man must do when he finds the man who should have been his father relatively late in life. He met this man on the evening he and his wife and his two children moved into the big white frame house in Ludlow. Winston Churchill moved in with them. Church was his daughter Eileen's cat. The search committee at the university had moved slowly. The hunt for a house within commuting distance of the university had been hair-raising, and by the time they neared the place where he believed the house to be, all the landmarks are right, like the astrological signs the night before Caesar was assassinated, Lewis thought morbidly. They were all tired and tense and on edge. Gage was cutting teeth and fussed almost ceaselessly. He would not sleep, no matter how much Rachel sang to him. She offered him the breast, even though it was off his schedule. Gage knew his dining schedule as well as she, better maybe, and he promptly bit her with his new teeth. Rachel, still not entirely sure about this move to Maine from Chicago, where she had lived her whole life, burst into tears. Eileen promptly joined her. In the back of the station wagon, Church continued to pace restlessly as he had done for the last 3 days it had taken him to drive here from Chicago. His yowling from the cat kennel had been bad, but his restless pacing after they finally gave up and set him free in the car had been almost as unnerving. Lewis himself felt a little like crying. A wild but not unattractive idea suddenly came to him. He would suggest that they go back to Bangor for something to eat while they waited for the moving van. And when his three hostages to fortune got out, he would floor the accelerator and drive away without so much as a look back. Foot to the mat, the wagon's huge four-barrel carburetor gobbling expensive gasoline. He would drive south, all the way to Orlando, Florida, where he would get a job at Disney World as a medic under a new name. But before he hit the turnpike, big old 95 southbound, he would stop by the side of the road and put the fucking cat out, too. Then they rounded a final curve, and there was the house that only he had seen up until now. He had flown out and looked at each of the 7 possibles they had picked from photos once the position of the University of Maine was solidly his, and this was the one he had chosen. A big old New England colonial, but newly sited and insulated. The heating costs, while horrible enough, were not out of line in terms of consumption. 3 big rooms downstairs, 4 more up, a long shed that might be converted to more rooms later on. All of it surrounded by a luxuriant sprawl of lawn, lushly green even in this August heat. Beyond the house was a large field for the children to play in, and beyond the field were woods that went on damn near forever. The property abutted state lands, the realtor had explained, and there would be no development in the foreseeable future. The remains of the Mi'kmaq Indian tribe had laid claim to nearly 8,000 acres in Ludlow and in the towns east of Ludlow, and the complicated litigation involving the federal government as well as that of the state might stretch into the next century. Rachel stopped crying abruptly. She sat up. "Is that..." "That's it," Lewis said. He felt apprehensive. No, he felt scared. In fact, he felt terrified. He had mortgaged 12 years of their lives for this. It wouldn't be paid off until Eileen was 17. He swallowed. "What do you think?" "I think it's beautiful," Rachel said. And that was a huge weight off his chest and off his mind. She wasn't kidding, he saw. It was in the way she was looking at it as they turned in the asphalted driveway that curved around to the shed and back, her eyes sweeping the blank windows, her mind already ticking away at such matters as curtains and oilcloth for the cupboards and God knew what else. "Daddy," Ellie said from the back seat. She had stopped crying as well. Even Gage had stopped fussing. Lewis savored the silence. "What, love?" Her eyes, brown under darkish blonde hair in the rearview mirror, also surveyed the house, the lawn, the roof of another house off to the left in the distance, and the big field stretching up to the woods. "Is this home?" "It's going to be, honey," he said. "Hooray!" she shouted, almost taking his ear off. And Lewis, who could sometimes become very irritated with Ellie, decided he didn't care if he never clapped an eye on Disney World in Orlando. He parked in front of the shed and turned off the wagon's motor. The engine ticked. In the silence, which seemed very big after Chicago and the bustle of State Street and the Loop, a bird sang sweetly in the late afternoon. "Home," Rachel said softly, still looking at the house. "Home," Gage said, complacently on her lap. Lois and Rachel stared at each other. In the rearview mirror, Eileen's eyes widened. "Did you? Did he? Was that?" They all spoke together, then all laughed together. Gage took no notice. He only continued to suck his thumb. He'd been saying "ma" for almost a month now, and had taken a stab or two at something that might have been "da," or only wishful thinking on Lewis's part. But this, either by accident or imitation, had been a real word. Home. Lewis plucked Gage from his wife's lap and hugged him. That was how they came to Ludlow. 2. In Lewis Creed's memory, that one moment always held a magical quality, partly perhaps because it really was magical, but mostly because the rest of the evening was so wild. In the next 3 hours, neither peace nor magic made an appearance. Lewis had stored the house keys away neatly. He was a neat and methodical man, was Lewis Creed, in a small manila envelope, which he had labeled Ludlow House, Keys Received June 29. He had put the keys away in the Fairlane's glove compartment. He was absolutely sure of that. Now they weren't there. While he hunted for them, growing increasingly irritated, Rachel hoisted Gage onto her hip and followed Eileen over to the tree in the field. He was checking out the seats for the third time when his daughter screamed and then began to cry. "Lewis," Rachel called, "she's cut herself." Eileen had fallen from the tire swing and hit a rock with her knee. The cut was shallow, but she was screaming like someone who had just lost a leg. Lewis thought, a bit ungenerously. He glanced at the house across the road where a light burned in the living room. "All right, Ellie," he said, "that's enough. Those people over there will think someone's being murdered." "But it hurts." Lewis struggled with his temper and went silently back to the wagon. The keys were gone, but the first aid kit was still in the glove compartment. He got it and came back. When Ellie saw it, she began to scream louder than ever. "No, not the stingy stuff. I don't want the stingy stuff, Daddy, no." "Eileen, it's just mercurochrome, and it doesn't sting." "Be a big girl," Rachel said. "It's just..." "No, no, 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 no." "You want to stop that, or your ass will sting," Lewis said. "She's tired, Lou," Rachel said quietly. "Yeah, I know the feeling. Hold her leg out." Rachel put Gage down and held Eileen's leg, which Lewis painted with mercurochrome in spite of her increasingly hysterical wails. "Someone just came out on the porch of that house across the street," Rachel said. She picked Gage up. He had started to crawl away through the grass. "Wonderful," Lewis muttered. "Lou, she's tired, I know." He kept the mercurochrome and looked grimly at his daughter. "There. And it really didn't hurt a bit. Fess up, Ellie." "It does. It does hurt. It hurt." His hand itched to slap her, and he grabbed his leg hard. "Did you find the keys?" Rachel asked. "Not yet," Lewis said, snapping the first aid kit closed and getting up. Gage began to scream. He was not fussing or crying, but really screaming, writhing in Rachel's arms. "What's wrong with him?" Rachel cried, thrusting him almost blindly at Lewis. It was, he supposed, one of the advantages of having married a doctor. You could shove the kid at your husband whenever the kid seemed to be dying. "Lewis, what's..." The baby was grabbing frantically at his neck, screaming wildly. Lewis flipped him over and saw an angry white knob rising on the side of Gage's neck. And there was also something on the strap of his jumper, something fuzzy, squirming weakly. Eileen, who had become quieter, began to scream again. "Bee, bee, bee!" She jumped back, tripped over the same protruding rock on which she had already come a cropper, sat down hard, and began to cry again in mingled pain, surprise, and fear. "I'm going crazy," Lewis thought wonderingly. "Whee! Do something, Lewis. Can't you do something?" "Got to get the stinger out," the voice behind them drawled. That's the ticket. Get the stinger out and put some baking soda on it. Bump will go down. But the voice was so thick with Down East accent that for a moment, Lewis's tired, confused mind refused to translate the dialect. Got to get the stinger out and put some baking soda on it. She'll go down. He turned and saw an old man of perhaps 70, a hale and healthy 70, standing there on the grass. He wore a bibbles over a blue chambray shirt that showed his thickly folded and wrinkled neck. His face was sunburned, and he was smoking an unfiltered cigarette. As Lewis looked at him, the old man pinched the cigarette out between his thumb and forefinger and pocketed it neatly. He held out his hands and smiled crookedly, a smile Lewis liked at once, and he was not a man who took to people. Not to tell you your business, Doc, he said. And that was how Lewis met Judson Crandall, the man who should have been his father. 3. He had watched them arrive from across the street and had come across to see if he could help, and it seemed they were in a bit of a tight, as he put it. While Lewis held the baby on his shoulder, Crandall stepped near, looked at the swelling on Gage's neck, and reached out with one blocky, twisted hand. Rachel opened her mouth to protest. His hand looked terribly clumsy and almost as big as Gage's head. But before she could say a word, the old man's fingers had made a single decisive movement, as apt and deft as the fingers of a man walking cards across his knuckles or sending coins into conjurer's limbo. And the stinger lay in his palm. Big un, he remarked. No prize winner, but it'd do for a ribbon, I guess. Lewis burst out laughing. Crandall regarded him with that crooked smile and said, Yeah, corker, ain't she? What did he say, Mommy? Eileen asked, and then Rachel burst out laughing, too. Of course, it was terribly impolite, but somehow it was okay. Crandall pulled out a deck of Chesterfield Kings, poked one into the seamed corner of his mouth, nodded at them pleasantly as they laughed. Even Gage was chortling now, in spite of the swelling of the bee sting, and popped a wooden match alight with his thumbnail. The old have their tricks, Lewis thought. Small ones, but some of them are good ones. He stopped laughing and held out the hand that wasn't supporting Gage's bottom. Gage's decidedly damp bottom. I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Judd Crandall, he said, and shook. You're the doc, I guess? Yes. Lewis Creed. This is my wife, Rachel, my daughter, Ellie, and the kid with the bee sting is Gage. Nice to know all of you. I didn't mean to laugh. That is, we didn't mean to laugh. It's just that we're a little tired. That, the understatement of it, caused him to giggle again. He felt totally exhausted. Crandall nodded. Course you are, he said, which came out, course you are. He glanced at Rachel. Why don't you take your little boy and your daughter over to the house for a minute, Mrs. Creed? We can put some baking soda on a wash rag and cool that off some. My wife would like to say hello, too. She don't get out too much. Arthritis got bad the last 2 or 3 years. Rachel glanced at Lewis, who nodded. That would be very kind of you, Mr. Crandall. Oh, I just answered to Judd, he said. There was a sudden loud honk, a motor winding down, and then the big blue moving van was turning, lumbering, into the driveway. Oh, Christ, and I don't know where the keys are, Lewis said. That's okay, Crandall said. I got a set. Mr. and Mrs. Cleveland, they that lived here before you, gave me a set, oh, must have been 14, 15 years ago. They lived here a long time. Joan Cleveland was my wife's best friend. She died 2 years ago. Bill went to that old folks' apartment complex over in Orrington. I'll bring him back over. They belong to you now anyway. You're very kind, Mr. Crandall, Rachel said. Not at all, he said. Looking forward to having young'uns around again. Except that the sound of this, as exotic to their Midwestern ears as a foreign language, was yowens. You just want to watch them around the road, Mrs. Creed. Lots of big trucks on that road. Now there was the sound of slamming doors as the moving men hopped out of the cab and came toward them. Ellie had wandered away a little, and now she said, Daddy, what's this? Lewis, who had started to meet the moving men, glanced back. At the edge of the field, where the lawn stopped and high summer grass took over, a path about 4 feet wide had been cut, smooth and close. It wound up the hill, curved through a low stand of bushes and a copse of birches, and out of sight. "Looks like a path of some kind," Lewis said.
"Oh, yeah," Crandall said, smiling.
"Tell you about it sometime, Missy. You want to come over and we'll fix your baby brother up?"
"Sure,"
Ellie said, and then added with a certain hopefulness, "Does baking soda sting?" 4. Crandall brought back the keys, but by then Lewis had found his set. There was a space at the top of the glove compartment, and the small envelope had slipped down into the wiring. He fished it out and let the movers in. Crandall gave him the extra set. They were in an old, tarnished fob. Lewis thanked him and slipped them absently into his pocket, watching the movers take in boxes and dressers and bureaus and all the other things they had collected over the 12 years of their marriage. Seeing them this way, out of their accustomed places, diminished them. Just a bunch of stuff in boxes, he thought, and suddenly he felt sad and depressed. He guessed he was feeling what people called homesickness. "Uprooted and transplanted," Crandall said, suddenly beside him, and Lewis jumped a little. "You sound like you know the feeling," he said.
"No, actually, I don't."
Crandall lit a cigarette. Pop went the match, flaring brightly in the first early evening shadows. "My dad built that house across the way. Brought his wife there, and she was taken with child there. And that child was me, born in the very year 1900. That makes you 83, Crandall said. And Lewis was mildly relieved that he didn't add years young, a phrase he cordially detested. "You look a lot younger than that," Crandall shrugged. "Anyway, I've always lived there. I joined up when we fought the Great War, but the closest I got to Europe was beyond New Jersey. Nasty place. Even in 1917, it was a nasty place. I was just as glad to come back here. Got married to my Norma, put in my time on the railroad, and here we still are. But I've seen a lot of life right here in Ludlow. I sure have." The moving man stopped by the shed entrance, holding the box spring that went under the big double bed he and Rachel shared. "Where do you want this, Mr. Creed?"
"Upstairs.
Just a minute, I'll show you." He started toward them, then paused for a moment and glanced back at Crandall.
"You go on," Crandall said, smiling. "I'll see how your folks are making out. Send him back over and get out of your way. But moving in's mighty thirsty work. I usually sit out on my porch about 9 and have a couple of beers. In warm weather, I like to watch the night come on. Sometimes Norma joins me. You come over, if you're a mind."
"Well, maybe I will," Lewis said, not intending to at all. The next thing would be an informal and free diagnosis of Norma's arthritis on the porch. He liked Crandall, liked his crooked grin, his offhand way of talking, his Yankee accent, which was not hard-edged at all, but so soft it was almost a drawl. A good man, Lewis thought, but doctors become leery of people fast. It was unfortunate, but sooner or later, even your best friends wanted medical advice. And with old people, there was no end to it. "But don't look for me or stay up. We've had a hell of a day." "Just so long as you know you don't need no engraved invitation," Crandall said. And there was something in the man's crooked grin that made Lewis feel that Crandall knew exactly what Lewis was thinking. He watched the old guy for a moment before joining the movers. Crandall walked straight and easily, like a man of 60 instead of over 80. Lewis felt that first faint tug of affection. 5. By 9 o'clock, the movers were gone. Ellie and Gage, both exhausted, were sleeping in their new rooms. Gage in his crib, Ellie on a mattress on the floor surrounded by a foothill of boxes. Her billions of Crayolas, whole, broken, and blunted. Her Sesame Street posters, her picture books, her clothes. Heaven knew what else. And, of course, Church was with her, also sleeping and growling rustily in the back of his throat. That rusty growl seemed the closest the big Tom could come to purring. Rachel had prowled the house restlessly with Gage in her arms earlier, second-guessing the places where Lewis had told the movers to leave things, getting them to rearrange, change, or restack. Lewis had not lost their check. It was still in his breast pocket, along with the 5 $10 bills he had put aside for a tip. When the van was finally emptied, he handed both the check and the cash over, nodded at their thanks, signed the bill of receipt, and stood on the porch watching them head back to their big truck.
He supposed they would probably stop over in Bangor and have a few beers to lay the dust. A couple of beers would go down well right now. That made him think of Judd Crandall again. He and Rachel sat at the kitchen table, and he saw the circles under her eyes. "You," he said, "go to bed." "Doctor's orders?" she asked, smiling a little. "Yeah." "Okay," she said, standing. "I'm beat. And Gage is apt to be up in the night. You coming?" He hesitated. "I don't think so just yet. That old fellow across the street... road. You call it a road out in the country. Or if you're Judson Crandall, I guess you'd call it a rud." "Okay, across the rud. He invited me over for a beer. I think I'm going to take him up on it. I'm tired, but I'm too jived up to sleep." Rachel smiled. "You'll end up getting Norma Crandall to tell you where it hurts and what kind of mattress she sleeps on." Lewis laughed, thinking how funny and scary it was, the way wives could read their husbands' minds after a while. "He was here when we needed him," he said. "I can do him a favor, I guess." "Barter system?" He shrugged, unwilling and unsure how to tell her that he had taken a liking to Crandall on short notice. "How's his wife?" "Very sweet," Rachel said. "Gage sat on her lap. I was surprised because he's had a hard day. And you know, he doesn't take very well to new people on short notice under the best of circumstances. And she had a dolly she let Eileen play with." "How bad would you say her arthritis is?"
"Quite bad."
"In a wheelchair?"
"No, but she walks very slowly. And her fingers..."
Rachel held her own slim fingers up and hooked them into claws to demonstrate. Lewis nodded. "Anyway, don't be late, Lou. I get the creeps in strange houses."
"It won't be strange for long," Lewis said, and kissed her.